At the end of part one, UFO investigator Lee Spiegel had just arrived at the Robeson County Sheriff's Office in Lumberton, North Carolina. It was Friday, April 4th, 1975 at 9:15 p.m., and it had been less than 48 hours since sightings of the triangle-shaped UFO began on Wednesday night. By this point, there had already been dozens of police who had become witnesses, as well as multiple high-speed chases, close encounters, and at least two incidents of what seemed to be communication with the craft via headlights and Morse code. By the time part two of this case concludes, Lee Spiegel will personally have multiple sightings. A new phenomenon will be seen which will not only leave physical traces, but also potential evidence. The town will become divided, and the process of a social hush-up will begin. This is the Lumberton Report, part two.
I didn't see you there.
It all started early this morning.
From hunting ghosts to Bigfoot, UFOs, cryptids, true crime, paranormal, and more.
I've always wanted to see a UFO.
Oh, I was researching for your entertainment.
That's Bigfoot's guess.
He basically wrote the book on Munnercle.
We aren't really comedians.
What if Buddha did cocaine?
The Adams Family on meth.
This is the Black Cat Report. See you on the other side. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 87 of The Black Cat Report. My name is Gil, and joining me here today is the original Dapper Dan man, Joey.
Indeed. I actually didn't even put any Dapper Dan on today, but my contract stipulates every other day I have to use it, so it's not today, but maybe tomorrow.
I was really hoping you were going to respond with, Meyer.
I'm a Dapper Dan man.
Now, before we dive into the final part of our coverage of the Lumberton Report, Joey and I have to take a moment to give a huge shout out and thank you to all the folks who called up and tuned in to episode two of Beer, Booze, and Boogeymen. Thank you all. Thank you all so much. That was fucking awesome.
Yeah, thank you. You guys are amazing. That was some fun calls, and the experiences you guys had really were great. We can't wait to hear the next ones.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be the first Saturday. I think it's pretty much going to be our schedule from now on, is the first Saturday of every month, sometime between, let's say, like 7 and 8 p.m. Eastern, and whatever that translates to for other time zones. If you didn't get a chance to see it live, a replay of Beer, Booze, and Boogeymen Episode 2 will be airing here on the Black Cat Reports podcast channel this Friday. Now, I also wanted to address a comment made by a longtime friend and listener of the show who asked me in earnest after hearing part one of the series, do you think people will believe it? And my snarky response was the same as always. I don't care if they do. If they don't, they should go read the docs. And he laughed in agreement, because that's the truth about this whole case, about this whole situation. But with that said, his question and this point still rings true for this case, more so than many of our past episodes. I mean, these are pretty big claims to be making, right?
Is it?
Well, this case, while incredible, has been all but lost. You're not going to find it well detailed in books, documentaries, lengthy articles, or any of the like. But that's the thing about what we do here. We don't want the common cases. We want to report on the forgotten, the ignored, the rare, the redacted. But when we do, we're going to give reference. And for this week, our primary source is the same as last week, the Lumberton Report. Full title, Report Number 3, The Lumberton Report, UFO Activity in South North Carolina, April 3rd through 9th, 1975, by Jenny Ziedman, Center for UFO Studies, Evanston, Illinois, USA, May 1976, Principal Investigators E. Lee Spiegel and Ted Phillips. The link to where you can go read, download, and share the report for free will be in the show notes. It's incredibly well written, contains tons of witness drawings, an excellent breakdown of witness reports, and has photos of the physical traces we'll be talking about today. This is the best UFO report I've ever read, which is why 90% of this episode will be direct quotes. I mean, there's no point in trying to fix something that ain't broken, in my opinion. So let's get back into it. If you recall where we left off in part one, Officer Ron Thompson had just called in his close encounter and subsequent high-speed chase of the UFO. Lee, as well as a reporter, and the Robeson County Sheriff's Office Director of Communications, Jay Freeman, were speeding towards the last known location of the craft. At 9:10 p.m., quote, minutes after Thompson's encounter, deputies had reported a UFO between Red Springs and Pembroke over Highway 710 heading south. At 9:31 p.m., a UFO was reported headed south over I-95 from St. Paul's. At 10:22 p.m., deputies were sighting a UFO between Pembroke and Maxton over North Carolina 74, and it was moving southeast. 10:49 p.m., a V-shaped object, surrounded by numerous lights, was seen flying at treetop level between Wakulla and Red Springs, headed northeast, end quote. Basically, the police reports are still coming in, and the directions are still lining up with subsequent sightings. Quote, by this time, Spiegel had joined Thompson, and they were cruising the area where the object had last been seen. At 11:45 p.m., near Red Springs, Spiegel and Thompson caught sight of a large, bright light, light only, no shape, getting brighter and moving easterly, just at treetop level, approximately 600 yards away. Spiegel reported, the light seemed to be coming closer due to the increasing brightness of it. After stopping the car, we heard no noise from it. Then it turned totally red, pulsating every 1.5 to 2 seconds. And then I noticed on the other side of the road, flying in the same direction at approximately 30 to 40 feet above the trees, another red light, pulsating at the same rate as the first. The two lights were soon out of sight, end quote.
Wow.
Now, there is a footnote in the Lumberton report I find revealing, actually. Quote, Spiegel was not impressed by these lights. Their motion was not unusual, and if he had not been actively, quote, UFO hunting, he would not have paid particular attention to them, end quote. That, to me, says something. It speaks a little bit to, like, integrity, right? So even with the excitement of all this going on, Lee wasn't just going to call any old light a UFO, right?
Yeah. Well, that's crazy, because now we've got, you know, like we talked about in other UFO encounters and UFO experiences, that there's never a UFO investigator on the ground, and now we have him literally in a cop car in the, so I guess he's probably in the passenger seat right now with the other cop, just like looking up, looking around. Mm-hmm. Sees a red light. He's like, that's fine. Oh, there's another one. That's also okay. That's fine. You know, not being like the cop that's like, are you looking at this? Do you see these red lights? He's just like,
freeze. Choo, choo, choo.
Yeah, freeze. Choo, 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 choo. It's like, I'm sorry, sir, that the UFO didn't have a gun. Oh, well, we'll just sprinkle some dust on it. It'll be fine.
Thought I heard an acorn. But yeah, it's about to pick up very quick, actually, like pretty much this next quote coming up here. But I do want to say, I imagine Lee is the one behind the wheel the whole time, just like goes up to the cop, like, get out of the way, I got this.
Yeah, kicks him out of the car. It's mine now.
You don't even know where you're driving. I got this.
You're not allowed to drive this cop car.
Licensed KUFOS investigator.
You see this badge? Sir, that's just a piece of paper.
Sir, that's a Kroger's Plus card.
Exactly. Move over. Well, you get free gas.
I don't see your badge getting you points. But yeah, you're 100% right. Well, let's fast forward a little bit now. Quote, it was now Saturday morning, April 5th at 1:30 a.m. Spiegel and Thompson were now driving along Philadelphia Road just outside of Pembroke when a deputy radioed that a V-shaped craft was heading north near their location. Spiegel reported, it appeared to us at first as a white light moving very slowly about 15 to 20 feet above a line of trees that was about 500 to 600 feet away from us. A large open field separated us from the tree line. We stopped the car to get a better view of the light. Weather conditions were on our side, a perfectly clear starry night, no moon, and extremely quiet surroundings. As the light moved in a northerly direction, it would stop and start again, always moving very slowly. The brightness of the light precluded our seeing any structure. At this point, Communications Director Freeman and reporter Dougherty pulled up in another car and confirmed what we were seeing. We turned off car engines and headlights. The craft stopped. The light became intensely bright, like a magnesium flare, I thought, and others agreed. It was difficult to look directly at it. It hovered for a minute, and the only audible sound was that of numerous dogs barking in the background.
Hey.
Meanwhile, a car with three Robeson County deputies was at a closer point than we were to the craft, and they radioed to us that they could see the V-shaped structure of it and that it was making no sound whatsoever. After the short time it remained motionless, the object changed in the flash of an eye to a totally red color and began to pulsate at a rate of 2 seconds and moved slowly back the way it had come, now southerly. We noted its irregular movement at this time, stopping and starting as it did before. Our total time of observation before it disappeared behind some trees southwest of us was 6 minutes. The deputies who had been closer joined us shortly after and told us the object had come around in a circle, hovered a short time, made a turn, and slowly moved off, picking up speed to about 35 miles an hour. End quote.
Wow.
Much better observation that time.
Yeah. So we're on day three, correct, of this, what I think is a flap.
Yeah, this is 100% a flap.
You're getting these red lights, you know, starting. Basically, Lee Spiegel is going through this whole, like, association of what these cops and what people in the county have been dealing with every night. He's going through it literally on one drive-through.
Mm-hmm.
So he's driving. He's like, okay, two red lights, sees them. He's like, that's fine. No big deal. And they stop. And then he sees the triangle-shaped spacecraft. And he's just like, that's new. And he's like, that's number two. And he just sees it. And he's like, he's going through this whole thing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, people are also still probably in the same way, still calling in, probably calling in the traffic troller, calling in the police station, just being like, hey, guys. Day three of us calling in. There's more coming, you know? Like, what is this stuff?
Can't wait to tell Hynek about this.
Yeah. He's like, wait till Hynek sees about this.
Well, but like, that's a really great point. But I also want to say here, the significance of this moment gets deeper the more we kind of like look at the situational details a little bit more. So just in that moment right there, we got five cops, one reporter, and one professional UFO investigator who all just stared at this craft for 6 minutes.
Yeah.
That's a long fucking time to be staring at something.
It is.
When it's like 500-600 feet away from, you know, a handful of them and like 100 or so feet away from the other group of them. So that's seven professionally trained observers all witnessing this unknown craft behaving in a way that even now, almost 50 years later, modern aircraft are not able to achieve silently. It's 2024. We're a year away from this happening 50 years ago. We don't have technology like this. Even drones make sounds.
Yep. Sound like beehives.
And like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do want to say, too, there's only one person in this whole story, and that kind of, for the most part, that has ever heard what the crafts sound like. And it's that one cop who stopped in the middle of the road with the trees along him. You know, and just like listened, and he was the only one that heard the low buzz and humming noise. Everybody else has been completely silent, which is just a very interesting case, you know?
It is. No, it's, I struggled with listing him as specifically the only one to report the sound, because in the summary, there's a brief, you know, breakdown at the very beginning of the report, where it has like, this is how many people saw a craft of this size, this is how many people saw it of this size, this is how many that said no sound, this is how many that said sound.
Mm-hmm.
And they list about, I believe, going off memory here, it was like 22 folks reported sound, some sort of sound, to go with the craft. That's not outlined in the final published report.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, just mention 22 people.
Yeah, because, you know, we're dealing with like, damn near 100 witnesses. So like this final published report, which was actually like, you know, published and distributed and yada yada, it gives the high level overview of a shit ton of events, you know.
Yeah.
So that guy wasn't technically, but he also wasn't like, him hearing the sound does stand out still. It still does stand out to me. And I really loved what you said about the the trees kind of creating that acoustic, like, that funnel going down, you know, onto him. Like, that makes sense. And I do honestly believe that, you know, it may have been a case of just frequencies that, you know, the older you get, the more that they quite literally, you can't hear them. They're just completely set. He may have been some, like, 20-year-old cop who, like, still had his hearing, you know? But like I was saying, though, like, with this whole situation, so 7 professionally trained observers, right? That's what we're dealing with. We have a reporter, UFO investigator, and 5 cops. They're all trained in different ways to observe, report, to witness. And they're professionals. And at this time, trees were not tossing and thrashing around, right? Which would have been very noticeable.
Yeah.
And the light was not silhouetted at an unknown altitude in the sky. No, the object was clearly visible, low to the ground, 15, 20 feet above the trees, and seen from multiple angles. This was not an optical illusion of something way up high where the, you know, the wind that's being, like, displaced below the craft would have, like, not been visible and the sound wouldn't have been. No, no, no. This is, like, it's right there.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the top. I'm looking at the canopy and nothing's moving. It's just fucking hovering. And it's moving in weird ways, like stopping, starting, moving in a circle. Well, moving on from there, quote, 15 minutes later at 1:45 a.m., 6 miles south of St. Paul's on State Road 1765, Highway Patrolman M.D. McGee reported seeing an object which had a brilliant white light at the top, appeared to be about 30 feet across, and had reddish-orange lights on both of its sides. 15 minutes later, quote, at 2 a.m., Spiegel and Thompson were once again in pursuit of a mystery object which stayed in sight for 10 minutes.
Wow.
Quoting within the quote, it kept changing its direction of flight, Spiegel reported. From our vantage point, traveling south down road 1006 near Red Springs, we could make out 3 lights on the craft, all of which were pulsating back and forth in a 1-2-3, 1-2-3 pattern. Again, it was lost behind trees until we saw it again at 2:15 a.m. as we were driving along Rural Paved Road 1752, approximately 10 miles west of Lumberton. The object seemed to be moving in a downward plane over Road 1518 in an erratic manner. Again, it appeared to move, stop, move as we attempted to follow it. As we drove down Road 1752, the craft was on our left, sometimes hidden by a constant line of trees on that side of the road. We seemed to be catching up to it at 90 miles an hour, but then it picked up speed and crossed 1752, going northeast in the direction of St. Paul's. Ron Thompson alerted the St. Paul's Police Department, but it wasn't seen by them. 45 minutes later, at about 3 a.m., 15 miles east of Lumberton, patrolman Gordon Hester viewed an object while it was circling the water tower in the town center of Dublin, North Carolina. It was at treetop level, and at one point, it just stopped and hovered for about 10 minutes. It was V-shaped and had a very intense bright light on the front of it that hurt my eyes to look at. For a minute, I thought it might hit the top of the water tower. At its closest point to me, I would estimate it was 300 feet directly over my head. It was no airplane, and it made no sound at all. After circling slowly, it took off real fast, headed west. Hester also stated that the object made flat, unbanked turns and had a revolving, not blinking, red light under each side of it. There were larger lights out on the wingtips and other lights of intermittent color and size. There were other scattered observations in the Lumberton area over the next few days. Of particular interest is the Strickland-Locklear sighting near Pembroke. End quote.
Hey.
Again, like, they were quite literally chasing this craft.
Yeah, yeah. Just driving down the road looking up.
And close enough to see that the lights on it were blinking in a pattern. Then another officer out in the direction that the craft was going before it outran them, right? Spiegel and company. Another officer, 300 feet above him, as he was, like, sitting there staring at it at a water tower. And he was just like, what the fuck am I looking at right now? Quite literally said, it was not an airplane.
Yeah.
Like, no, it was not. No. You know?
Yeah, for sure. I wonder if those red lights that are on the... You said there's three red lights that are like alternating or whatever underneath the craft spiraling. Maybe that's what the orbs could have been, you know, that they were seeing the red orbs. I don't know. I'm just making like a kind of a comparison between the two of the people seeing like the red light over here, the red light over here. It could have been different ships, just didn't have all their lights on. I don't know. And maybe there's what could have been. They could have been seeing the same things, just lights on.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of one thing that's like, you know, it's hard to see is like if there's no lights on these things, you'd just be looking up and see kind of like darkness, especially if you're at like 2 a.m., you know, and the moon's not big, you're going to just see darkness and you're not going to see stars in that area. So unless it's 200 feet yeah, above you, which then you're just the like, fuck? I see that clearly.
Yeah.
But if it's far enough away, you might just only see that. And then if there's like a red light, you might only see that red light.
Yeah, that's a good point. So here's the thing, like, back in my train hopping days, you know, you'd always make sure, I would always make sure, and a lot of other train hoppers would too, and anybody that's kind of up to anything nefarious at night, that when you have your headlamp, right, the first click to turn on the light, a good headlamp, the first click will do red light. Because red light, A, won't ruin your night vision, right? So it can take upwards of a half an hour for your eyes, for your pupils to fully dilate so that you can see in the dark, to adjust to the darkness, right? And the second they get exposed to white light,
gone.
You have to start back over again. So red light helps a lot, especially when you're sneaking around train yards and like past security and you're doing a bunch of illegal shit like hopping trains. But there's another thing to the red light too, which is a distinct advantage, which is it's incredibly hard to see red light from far away. It's really easy to see white lights from far away, but you could be, you know, depending on conditions, 50 feet, 60 feet away from somebody who has a bright red headlight or, you know, headlamp or whatever, like on shining in the forest. And you can be 50 feet away in the woods looking straight in that direction and not see shit, right? But if they click on white light, it's like, boom, like it's super visible.
Yeah.
The same goes to some extent, if not more, with blue light. So with the proximity of the folks that are seeing these reds and blue lights, it makes sense that when folks are farther away, they're seeing a white light and that's all they're seeing. But when they're right up next to it, they're seeing reds and blues and like, you know, slight variations of those colors along with the white light.
Yeah.
That's quite literally how our eyes take in the light spectrum, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, to be fair, though, if I'm traveling down the highway, I can see a cop pulling someone over like about 100 miles away. You know, you can see that light blaring everywhere. You can see that. And you know to slow down when you're going 100.
That's also intentionally trying to reflect the light towards you. You know what I'm saying? Like, that is meant to reflect.
Yeah. So you know that they're there. Yeah.
And those lights also do have like a higher white light spectrum in them.
There is a white light in there as well. It switches from red, blue, white in there. That's they tread so you can see.
But like, but I can tell you from being, you know, 45 feet away from, you know, white train yard security trucks, it's 100% accurate. And I'm glad you brought that up because I hadn't put those two things together.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here is where something special happens. Quote, the daylight lights case. The sightings, which took place on Sunday afternoon, April 6, 1975, near Pembroke, comprise a different category of UFO report, daylight observation with possible ground traces. These events are of interest because two separate multiple witness observations and another observation by one individual of apparently the same object took place simultaneously from three separate, though close, locations. Ray Strickland, 35, a deputy sheriff, his wife, a public school teacher, and their two daughters, ages 13 and 10, were driving north at a speed of about 50 miles per hour on the Philadelphia Road, 1.5 miles north of Pembroke, at 5:15 p.m. on April 6, 1975. The sky was almost totally clear. Temperature 62 degrees, wind 31 degrees, and 12 knots. Strickland noticed the objects first and called them to the attention of the others. They observed a group of five, quote, big pink and reddish lights, end quote, flying as a unit, which passed in front of their car in a descending angle and appeared to land in a field approximately 400 feet to the right, east, of the road. The lights were seen through the windshield and the closed side windows of the Strickland car. Each light had a bluish streak or tail behind it, which appeared to be about twice the length of the light diameter. Strickland's impression was that the lights were about 12 inches in diameter and the streaks were 24 inches long. The lights did not vary in intensity or color, and the trajectory or flight path remained a constant shallow angle. The distance to the lights stayed about the same as we were driving towards it, and it was moving away at an angle, Strickland reported. I started braking as soon as I saw it. The lights were about 100 feet above the ground and about 350 feet away. I would say they were moving at about 100 miles per hour. They were flying in a tight formation that never changed. As the lights flew in front of my car, they seemed to be coming down and were headed towards a house off to our right. My wife was sure the lights were going to hit the house, so I turned into the dirt road leading to it, and we could see the lights going down beyond the house into a potato field. With the house in the way, we couldn't actually see the lights land. Three young boys were sitting on the porch, and another boy, David F., age 12, was standing in the yard as the Stricklands drove into the driveway. David was the only one who saw the objects. I saw two big balls of fire come down, David said. They were red, and they had a little spot of yellow in the middle. David did not see the tails or streaks on the objects. However, he and another boy named Greg saw the smoke when the objects landed. It hit the ground and then left a big ball of smoke. It was grayish smoke, not real dark. It made dust come up, and you couldn't see it then. That smoke went up as high as the house, single-story house. None of the observers saw any objects or lights ascend from the apparent landing site. Strickland did not go back to the potato field immediately, but drove his family home, about 2 miles, so they could dress for church. He phoned Ron Thompson to meet him at the site, and then Strickland drove back to the site alone and met Thompson there a half an hour later. They walked out to the potato field. Quote, we discovered six circular patches of a bluish color ash where the lights had apparently come down, Strickland said. Each patch was about a foot in diameter, and they were situated on the ground in the same pattern as I had seen the lights flying in the air. The owners of the house were away during this time period, however, they later stated that the circular patches had not been noticed earlier. A photographer was called to the scene, and Thompson then obtained samples of the affected soil. It was later learned through police dispatch reports that another couple had simultaneously observed the lights as they descended. Colonel Locklear, 57, and his wife, Ethel, 56, were driving the Philadelphia Road in the opposite direction as the Stricklands. Locklear said, I thought it was an airplane about to crash. I seen it down through the treetops. It was a little after 5. It looked like a body of some kind with a light shining on it. Like spray-painted cotton or something. It looked like a short body, kind of clear red. Mrs. Locklear said she saw two red lights, which might have been 12 inches in diameter. Something was across them with the sun shining on it. It looked like real pretty chrome, and them lights, they were just clear and red shining. Just as red, a clear red. I didn't see a body, just a chrome bar between the lights. We were heading south towards Pembroke. They went into the trees. If there had been an opening, we could have seen something. It went deep enough into those trees. That chrome was just as bright, shining like aluminum foil. End quote.
Hey, that's crazy. So they are now seeing these other lights coming out too, the similar red lights that we saw at the beginning of the story where Lee Spiegel was like driving down the road. And also white lights as well, right? So two different colored lights coming down, hitting the ground in a random, well, I guess, in the formation that they were falling, I guess, or descending.
Uh-huh.
But then when they got there about 30 minutes later, the other two, nothing there besides just like the imprints, right? There's no like lights, there's no bodies, there's no nothing. There's only the idea that something hit the ground and the physical evidence that something hit the ground.
Yeah. Moving on further to analyze. Like I said, it wasn't just the fact that these lights were seen by multiple groups of witnesses and that they returned in the middle of the day and yada yada. There's more. There's a study. There's photographs. There's going to be soil analysis of where these objects apparently landed or did something, right, in this potato field. Quote, the Strickland-Locklear sightings near Pembroke, Sunday, April 6 at 5:15 p.m., cannot be explained in terms of known actual phenomenon or during the flight phase of fabricated material. The object slash lights, simultaneously observed from three different angles, literally disappeared in a puff of smoke. Ted Phillips has written, the direction of flight is solid. Seven witnesses, and the wind direction was 32 degrees at 12 knots. In other words, the lights were moving almost against the wind and certainly across it. This would indicate a powered vehicle of some kind. Flares would also have been attached to something. Only the lights were seen. Also, the witnesses agreed that the lights were following a descending flight path. They cleared the 35 to 40 foot tall trees and must have suddenly dropped vertically into the site because of dense tall trees located at the other side of the site along the flight path. If they had not dropped into the field, they would have struck the trees to the northeast of the site. There was no visible damage to any of the trees along the flight path, so the lights either dropped vertically into the field, suddenly climbed over the trees to the northeast, or just disappeared. That is a real puzzle. Perhaps the spots in the field are not connected with the lights, although the young boy did claim that he saw a cloud of dust or smoke coming from the area after he saw them hit the ground. I talked with the owners of the house, which is less than 100 feet from the site, and they had no explanation for the spots in the field. Like many other UFO reports, more questions than answers. End quote. Now, the report later goes on to state, quote, samples of the residue mixed with soil and control samples of soil taken from a few feet away were analyzed by a consulting laboratory of the Center for UFO Studies. Some basic tests using the X-ray fluorescence analysis system were conducted. The sample was found to be abnormally high in strontium. Strontium is a primary component in flares. No particles larger than ash size were found. If the object slash lights were pieces of space debris, it is unlikely that, from the time the material passed over the road until it hit the potato field, there would have been an opportunity for total disintegration. When a visual examination of the field was made 6 months later, in mid-October, no traces of the ash were evident, and the ground and crops appeared totally normal. End quote.
Hey, interesting. It's used for flares as well as it's used for like glow-in-the-dark paint, but it's commonly found in like rocks. I just Googled it, so it makes it easier. It's commonly found in like coal, rocks, iron. It's just a interesting mix. But interesting that it is like that was very much in quotations, I'd like to say, crash site of these lights.
So that's the thing, too, is like the way that they took samples. It was like, you know, here's the direct spots with like the bluish ash on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're going to go 12 feet away in a circular radius, take samples. Now we're going to go, you know, 24 feet. Now we're going to go 50 feet. Now we're going to go 200 feet. Take all of those samples and look for differences as we get closer. And there was just a dramatic difference in the amount the second you got to those points of ash on the ground. And I do want to like harken back. It was just me pushing too much here, but like harken back to essentially something that like Jacques Vallée has said a million times over, which is, you know, like, hey, why do we think that spacecraft or anything else, like, why would we think that they're using any kind of like elements different than what we use? It's the same building blocks across the universe.
Yeah.
Like, why do we assume that their craft isn't just made out of aluminum?
Yeah.
So like when we're going and we're doing, you know, these samples of things and we're looking and we're like, is this a piece of a craft? No, it's just a piece of aluminum. And it's like, well, why couldn't they just also make crafts out of aluminum? Why are we assuming that they're working with different metals than us?
Yeah, for sure. And think about it too, is that like, you know, it could be the same type of metal, just used in different ways, you know?
Exactly.
It's just, it's an interesting thing to think about in that they probably are right. If you're subscribed to the Big Bang that created everything, like we had talked about with black holes blowing up.
Yeah.
All those, it's the same materials being shot out from that place. So most,
yeah.
Most every, you know, rock is going to have some similar, not all the same, but some similar materials to create it. So if there's anything across the universe that somebody's flying through, it's probably going to have some semblance of the same ideas, same things, just could be used molecularly differently,
yeah,
to make the style of they need. Or, hey, it could also subscribe to that maybe they're us in the future using the same materials. So, like, all it depends on how you view it.
Yeah, but elements are elements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's a basic building block, you know? So it's like,
yeah,
doesn't change. It doesn't change what it is, you know?
Yeah. And it begs the question, or it's like kind of, it's very odd. I don't know if all the talk back and forth ever really became, if I was able to convey it clearly in the quotes, but, you know, you have these lights that are coming down very fast across the road in front of multiple witnesses and near another witness, you know, hard angle coming down like a plane landing.
Uh-huh.
They clear the top of a tree line, right? And on the opposite side of the tree line is this potato field. But what happened was they're coming down to this hard angle. Everybody's watching them come in, you know. They clear the top of the trees. And the second they get over the top of the trees, they drop straight down.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it right? doesn't happen.
Which is weird,
yeah.
You know. And the way that they know that they drop straight down, other than, you know, just the path and everything, was that if they would have continued at the angle that they would have had to continue that if they were following a natural flight path, say as like
yeah.
flares with parachutes attached to them or anything else, they would have hit trees on the opposite end of the potato field.
Yeah.
They would have just kept going down an angle and just crashed straight into them, right? But they didn't. They've cleared the tree line and dropped straight down to
mm-hmm.
the ground. And again, the whole time they're going against and across the wind. So like
yeah, yeah.
that's a whole nother can of worms. But if it was some crazy ass flare dropped out of a high altitude plane at a very fast speed and, you know, some crazy ass rogue flares that were flying down there, still the trajectory of like how they went and how they dropped doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
They were like, yeah, doop, straight down.
They'd
to the
have
ground.
To be, yeah, diagonally and then whoops and straight down and like defy all the laws of aeronautics and gravity to do that.
Yeah. They had to, they tripped on a branch. Like,
yeah. Whoops.
Poof. Now, as promised in part one, we're going to have to follow up with Mr. Floyd, nighttime security specialist and American hero, putting his life on the line to protect fine textiles and knitting at the Almack Knitting Mill located just outside of Lumberton. I tease because I think Mr. Floyd is a hoaxer. And here's why. Quote, Sunday morning, it came over the trees, headed for the building again, and the front light on the object became brighter than anything I've ever seen, and it was shining right down toward the ground. The other lights on it were different, red and blue ones that sometimes quivered. When it got to within approximately 10 feet of the front of the building, the five big night lights, security spotlights on the building, all went out and stayed off for about 5 minutes, and the thing was just hovering there all this time. When it moved away, the lights gradually came back on, and it just kept traveling westerly. These are five of about 30 such lights surrounding the building, and all are powered by one main switch. Only the five lights were affected. Mr. Floyd saw the object again on Tuesday and Wednesday mornings. It came by at the same time. 2:30 a.m. from the same direction, circled the canal, and then left, heading east. Floyd did not work Sunday night, and no unusual phenomenon were reported by the guard on duty at that time. Mr. Floyd had other puzzling UFO-related experiences, which, as bizarre as they may seem, should be mentioned if a comprehensive picture of the Lumberton events is to be obtained. In the week following the sightings, before sunrise on the morning of Saturday, April 12, as Mr. Floyd was listening to his CB radio, he heard a strange, hollow-sounding voice that described itself as a robot broadcasting over South Carolina but heading towards North Carolina. After this, the signal did become much stronger, jamming the radios of several other residents so that they could not talk to each other. According to Lee Spiegel, who interviewed Mr. Floyd, the voice, speaking with a North Carolina intonation, said that it would broadcast again and that
it could not speak with them or be seen.
His ship, supposedly.
After dawn.
Duh.
It's about to get weird.
Okay, let's go there.
Still continuing on with a quoting from the report. On Saturday night, at Lee Spiegel's suggestion, Mr. Floyd had taken with him his son's cassette recorder. On his way home from work, Sunday morning between 7 a.m. and 7:15 a.m., he heard the voice again and recorded it. The quality of the tape is poor, and many words are inaudible over the background noise, but there are phrases Lee Spiegel was able to pick out and transcribe. Reading now from the transcript.
Yes, ma'am, we thank you. Modulating. We do have 104 in our equipment. We are clear. Robot, we are clear. We may be in violation of rules. You may be violating the rules and regulations of the National Loudmouth by modulating with this one robot. We may be violating...
You're breaking some rules, right you are?
Floyd speaking back on the radio.
Do not modulate with this one robot. We are circling around and checking out different, and they do not like for any voice to modulate with this one robot. We are not a N-word. We are not a white man. We are not an Indian. We are not a yellow man. We are not anything. We are just one robot. We are circling for the pleasure of our commanding vehicle. Anybody that does not like the sound of this one robot.
The next few words are from a recording that Floyd's son made after Floyd got home and the voice was still transmitting.
We are not anybody that we did from out there. We are not a computer, but we are robot. We are computerized. We do take the Earthling's words and twist it around and turn it against.
Months later, Mr. Floyd heard another broadcast by the same voice. End quote.
Wow.
I think
so.
Mr. Floyd's full of shit.
This is shit, because first off, a robot wouldn't call itself a robot. It wouldn't believe that it's a robot. It would think that it's its own consciousness, especially if it's trying to be its own thing. And it would not also call people Indian, you know, it wouldn't use those phrases. Yeah, the N-word. It wouldn't use those phrases in a slightly North Carolinian accent.
that part got me a little bit.
I mean, you know, most robots nowadays are made in North Carolina, so that's a head scratcher, right?
And they do point it out. They're like, later on in the Lumberton report, they do address this, and they're just kind of like, look, this feels like a complete hoax. This feels like it's complete bullshit. You know, a couple interesting parts of the fact that, like, it's phrasing, like, stays consistent. It stays in, like, the third person, whole time that it's, like, doing it. And it's I guess, like, overall, like, grammar was, like, very unique in it, which does stand out. But with UFO cases, like, they say, like, you kind of just got to, sometimes you got to keep the wheat and the chaff together. Just because you don't know what might pop up 30, 40, 50 years later, where it's just like, you know, CIA releases a recording from a radio tower of, like, strange robot voice, and it's like, that happened 2 months earlier, but it happened in Costa Rica, or it happened, you know, like, shit might add up over time, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Always got to include everything. It's just, you know, it's a report. It's not, you know, just you deciding what's real and what's not. It's just reporting on what's there. It's duty as a UFO investigator and, like, the person writing the summary to just, like, give everything they heard, you know, not just, like, and a lot of it's probably, you know, they're not giving their opinions about it either. They're most likely just being like, this is what we heard, this is what's there, you know. So that's part of the report.
Yeah. And in the conclusion section, that's where they're, you know, they kind of do break it down with, like, yeah, this sounds like bullshit, but main body of the report. I do have to agree, after, like, picking line by line by line through this entire goddamn report and, like, seeing what everybody else's witness statements were and their experiences and what close encounters and this and that, and Floyd stands out as, like, this only happened to you, bro. Like, this only happened to you.
Yeah, he's the only one.
Like, this shit that this, like, this is a little sketch.
The beginning, the lights, you know, you're like, okay, lights, you know, flying around the knitting factory. It's
fine.
That could, that possibly, that also possibly did happen.
Yeah.
Not exactly like you said, but the lights flying around it could possibly have happened. Not generally the lights flicking on and off, because no other report in there has said that there's been electromagnetic interference that I remember.
The radio interference.
The radio.
Early on.
Yeah.
Which it still stands out to me that the walkie-talkie worked, but the CB in the car didn't work. I mean, the CB would have been hooked up to the car battery, so maybe that was a I don't fucking know. I don't know.
Truth.
Electronic.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I don't want to spend too much time like just shitting on Mr. Floyd, but I feel like he was just kind of listening to shit happening all around the city on CB while he was there. And like,
and he wanted to be part of it.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to be part of it just a little bit. But anywho, moving on. Before this flap even ended, local news stations began making the claim that most, if not all, of these sightings were actually people mistaking nighttime flights of a Boeing 737 coming to or going from the Piedmont Airport. I can't say this. Like, this is completely fucking laughable. Like, even if you try to cherry pick a few of the less detailed sightings.
Yeah.
This is so far off from a possibility that it's insane.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it doesn't sound, that doesn't sound like, from everything everyone said, it doesn't sound like that's what they were seeing.
No, yeah, just, you know, 6 minutes here, 10 minutes here, slowly hovering over your head at like a walking pace, or completely paused, or directly stationed above a water tower with a spotlight shining down. Just any of this, that is so fucking, that is such a fucking stupid claim. And and in a second here, I'm gonna get into it, but like, obviously, you know, Kufos, the investigators, they completely tear this shit apart very, very fast. Because again, they're on the ground at the time. They're able to follow up with crap like this.
Yeah.
But this is an important moment, though, as a whole. And I think you'll, you know, in the next couple quotes, next couple sections, you'll see why this is an important moment. And this does build up to the social, like, hush up that, you know, I've been referencing throughout all this. So, anywho, like I said, so this case, right, and the Lumberton report as a whole, which just keeps giving and giving, shows how quickly Lee and Kufos clearly debunked this attempted debunking. Quote, phone calls made by Lee Spiegel to municipal and county airports within a 40-mile radius of Lumberton established with high probability that no locally based or commercial aircraft were operating in the area at the time. Radar operators at Grannis Field reported no contact with uncorrelated targets. This would be expected. The UFO was at a very low altitude and would have been lost in ground clutter, 15 feet above the trees.
Not high at all.
It was also established that control tower personnel at Fayetteville had begun to hear reports over their police monitor describing a V-shaped object an hour before the Piedmont jet had reached the area. Mr. Bob Dowry, radar operator on duty, stated that when the reports started to come in, the tower personnel were hoping to see something and possibly track it on radar, but they never had the opportunity. The Piedmont flight was making radar approaches and, of course, was an identified target at all times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So to kind of like stop quoting here for a second, just immediately they're like, oh, it's actually this, and it's a, you know, it's a 737 that does like night runs, basically like checking to make sure everything's operating all right. So it sometimes makes weird movements in the area, and that's what people have been seeing. The radar operators in the area are like, that's bullshit. We were hearing about the UFO all night. We could clearly see the 737 on radar. This shit wasn't lining up at all. Everything was going expected to it. And a lot of these reports were starting like an hour before the plane even took off.
Yeah.
It's impossible. It's complete. We
the
were
timing's
looking for
not
UFOs.
Right. Yeah. yeah. Like we saw, we know what we saw, you know?
Yeah. We know what we didn't saw. But it got shot down so quick, but the seed was planted in the media and in the population, right? So, continuing on. Quote, it has been suggested that the UFO might have been an A-8 Harrier aircraft. The Harrier, in use by the U.S. Marine Corps, is a delta-wing vertical short takeoff and landing jet craft. It can rise from the ground like a helicopter, hover, turn in any direction, and then move out with extremely rapid rates of climb. The craft has four vectored fan air nozzles under the wings, which deliver as much as 21,500 pounds of thrust. A tremendous amount of noise is generated by these engines, and I do not think it likely that in over two dozen separate instances, many with the observers less than 500 feet away, this could be confused with a soundless phenomenon. End quote.
No, yeah, definitely. Harrier's loud.
Yeah. Could you imagine being 200 feet directly below a Harrier? You would be a fucking pancake on the ground.
Yeah, you would die because you're not supposed to. That would be like being reading behind a jet engine when it lights up. Is like it just
literally
Yeah,
21,000 plus pounds of thrust straight down you, 200 feet below.
Yeah,
first
you would probably die.
You would be fucking deaf. Second off,
yep.
Just so much is wrong with that. Much. And to be like 10, 20 feet above trees, just slowly moving around, like, bro.
Yeah, without trees being bent or knocked over or anything like that.
Catching on fire and shit.
Catching on fire. Well, I think about it too. And like when you said, you know, first hovering about it, first thing that went through my mind was Harrier jet. And I was like, because they literally do hover. They move around. But most of the time they hover to get up. So they don't have a takeoff vector straight. They hover to get up and then go. But they're still not going. They're not just going straight up the whole time. Like, they're not going straight up. They're going, like, up. Mm-hmm. And then when they get to a good takeoff vector, they go out. And their turns are banked. Once they get to full speed, their turns
another
are banked.
Another important point.
Yeah. Their turns bank. And so it doesn't just go stop. They just can't stop on a dime and then go down. They have to, like, obviously slow down, get to a point where they can drop down, and then drop down. It's not the same idea.
This is not at all. Just like it isn't even close. Is it the closest thing we had in like human technology at the time to do something like this? Almost. A helicopter would have been closer, but would have been a hell of a lot fucking louder. And would not be taking off at the speeds that this thing takes off at.
No, helicopters are much slower.
Yeah. Well, as for the social hush-up, in the conclusion of the report, there is what I think is maybe one of the best summaries of the process of how something so significant as this case and the series of events get lost over time. Quote, some personal observations on the North Carolina investigations. A variety of reactions and attitudes toward UFOs, UFO observers, and UFO investigators were found within the confines of the North Carolina sightings. The witnesses themselves represented a range from minimally educated to minimally articulate rural people to policemen, a physics professor, and a UFO investigator. The population of Robeson County is one-third black, one-third white, and one-third Lumbee Indian. I was informed of these statistics shortly after my arrival and reminded of them at intervals. Remarks were made several times in an attempt to discredit non-white observers.
Classic.
Approximately 40 law enforcement personnel reported UFOs, and within this occupational category, a wide range of stimulus response was noted. There was a heckler ridiculer who, not having seen a UFO himself, took it upon himself to push down those who had. When the heckler ridiculer was a police chief and or a physically large person, his attitude may have been interpreted as a threat, and his subordinates may have been driven to either withdraw or pursue their UFO interest with discretion. There were several incidences in the North Carolina sightings when police officers who had initiated reports became unavailable to investigators once the attitude of their superior officers became known.
Yep, classic.
A prestige factor was also noted. Some UFO reporters described their experiences in a straightforward manner and were genuinely concerned with obtaining answers. Others took advantage of their sightings by hopping on the, quote, UFO bandwagon, attending any and every UFO-related meeting, and above all, making sure that their names were spelled correctly. A frustrating dilemma faced repeatedly by UFO investigators, and quite evident in this instance, was the apathy and procrastination of UFO observers in complying with center requests for written materials, documents, or photographs relating to their sightings. After the initial excitement of making an oral report, further efforts were apparently of little interest. Self-addressed, stamped queries from the center remained unanswered. Even when pursued by long-distance phone calls, it was too much trouble to Xerox a police report page and mail it. Sightings reports, forms mailed by the center to observers were not returned. FAA and airline cooperation was also hard to obtain, notwithstanding the FAA Facilities Management Handbook change effective April 1, 1975. Thus, much potentially valuable information remains unattainable, and a point was reached where decisions had to be made. Man hours, expenses, and travel time versus probable gain in personally interviewing a person who called the police to say, I saw it. Throughout the North Carolina investigations, a divergence of attitude among the general population is seen. A blind belief in UFOs as a manifestation of extraterrestrial visitation, a rejection of the UFO phenomenon in its entirety, or an almost total lack of interest in the subject. In the predominantly Baptist communities of this area, there is some conflict between basic religious tenets and any possibility of extraterrestrial life. In any case, the field of vision is narrow, and there appears to be little interest in philosophical and scientific exploration. The North Carolina sightings of April 1975 comprise a geographically confined flap, whose active phase lasted little more than 75 hours. Predominant in the reports are V-shaped objects and bright white lights. Predominant among the many observers are law enforcement personnel who presumably have somewhat better than average experience in observing and reporting. The UFO literature is replete with silent white lights of varying intensities. Some have been observed at apparently close range, and some of which have apparently reacted intelligently to the presence and actions of their human observers. V-shaped objects, although not classic UFOs, have been reported often enough and with sufficient continuity of characteristics that they should not be ignored. In the North Carolina sightings, the large number of witnesses and the consistency of their reports provided an opportunity to investigate and report these phenomena. End quote. I fucking love that summary.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great summary. I mean, basically says they were blocked. You know, they were blocked from anything at the end of it. Like, during the time of reporting and the time of seeing, it was, like, all hands on deck. Everybody was seeing it. Everybody was looking at it. And then when it comes time to, like, do the research into the background of it afterwards, it's like, nah, we don't want to be seen as people who believe in UFOs. Shut that down.
Yeah.
You know, they don't want the
social pressure.
They don't want the media saying it, because a lot of it could have affected some of those sheriffs and officers' jobs. And because especially
when
the
your
chief,
supervisors,
when he's is like,
when
no.
he's the heckler, just being like, "Well, y'all seen crazy lights tonight? I don't know if I should give you that promotion." And da 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 da. I need somebody I can rely on.
He's
you
just
know,
jealous.
Not somebody out here chasing like just shit going on like that. Then you have religious pressure going on.
Yep.
Then you have racism on top of that. Then you have like
shutting everything down.
It makes the shit, like the insanity of somebody saying it's a 737, more reasonable just so life can go on.
Yeah, you don't want to think about it.
No, but it also, you know, to me, it's one of the perfect ways to like to wrap up this episode, because it explains how quick this shit was getting hushed up while it was happening.
Mm-hmm.
Like, while the case was still going on, the social hush up, the social pressure was already starting to clamp down. No wonder this report hasn't expanded. No wonder it hasn't gone any farther than this.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There was an active, you know, I'm not saying it was like planned or orchestrated, but from a social level, in the same way that like making money motivates a lot of people and everybody's out at their jobs and they're doing shit, like that same way that capitalism motivates us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Under threats, right? Is the same way that everybody started to kind of hush up about this. I'm not saying that the men in black swooped in and just told everybody I've seen bigger or some shit, you know? I'm not saying that that happened, but I am saying very quickly the social reality did just as good of a job as the men in black coming in.
I mean, easy. Who wants to get their, like a lot of the UFO experiencers and UFO encounters get their life ruined by some of the stuff, you know, because of the social pressures.
Yep.
And their whole, like, families leave them sometimes, you know. They lose their jobs. So, like, a lot of these people are like, I don't like that. I would like to keep my job as a sheriff that I've probably, yep, some of them worked, or as an officer. Some of them either just started their career or just, like, have been working at 20, 30 years. And they're like, I'm getting close to retirement. It's not really worth, yep, ruffling feathers just to show this. Once I retire, I can go talk about it. But at the moment, no. And then it just gets forgotten because they're sitting there, you know, sitting on their porch smoking a pipe, retired. And then, you know, everybody's like, well, there's no money in going and digging up this now, you know?
And the irony is, this is 6 years after Blue Book was closed. Mm-hmm. Jalen Hynek helped push and create, like, intentionally, an atmosphere socially that isolated witnesses and made, mm-hmm, them shut the fuck up about seeing shit. That, yep, was one of J. Allen Hynek's jobs, with trying to debunk everything and discredit everything. And so it's there's an inherent irony that, like, 6 years after Blue Book ends, they're investigating a case and he's facing the repercussions. His investigators are facing the repercussions,
yeah,
of the past 2 decades, 22 years, from Project Sign to Project Grudge to Project Blue Book, of that intentionally being his job. Now he's facing the repercussions of it now,
yeah,
that he's, like, in the public sector. Yeah, I don't know. But, and I do want to say before we fully wrap up here, there is a bonus that I'm going to play after our initial outro. I've included the audio report I came across originally at New Forest on their website that spurred me to eventually find the Lumberton report. In this early recording, the witness directly mentions the triangle spotted in North Carolina and an article done by a reporter where he first read about it. I'm going to play a quick sample here. The actual audio clip, which I did do some work to restore, is 16 minutes long. Like I said, just consider it a little bonus at the end of the episode. But I think now that you've heard parts one and parts two, and you've seen the varying degrees of the phenomenon, when you listen to the 16-minute piece, you're going to realize, holy fuck, they're talking about the same thing a couple months later in Washington.
Report to State Patrol about, what is it, 3 weeks ago. Do you have my file there, whatever it was?
Was this the triangular-shaped object?
Right.
Okay.
And the reason I'm calling, I almost forgot about it, you know, and then I just picked up the Inquirer, and I'll be damned if his description didn't exactly match the thing that I saw.
Well, this is the one seen in North Carolina.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Hmm. Yep.
Yep.
Matching up where everyone's seeing everything.
So, yeah, it's a great little piece. A lot of the anomalies and the strangeness continue, and like I said at the beginning of the series, this is the first modern day flap of a triangle UFO. So, this was the start. Anyways, as always and forever, we love y'all. See you next week. Y'all are the shit. And bye.
Bye.
Report to State Patrol about, what is it, 3 weeks ago. Do you have my file there, whatever it was?
Was this the triangular-shaped object?
Right.
Okay.
And the reason I'm calling, I almost forgot about it, you know, and then I just picked up the Inquirer, and I'll be damned if his description didn't exactly match the thing that I saw.
Well, this is the one seen in North Carolina.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And their description is exactly, except for the color of the lights.
Okay, well, could we get the description of what you saw right from the beginning?
Okay, my girlfriend saw it, too. We were both, you want the whole story?
Yes.
Okay. We were driving up on Camino Island,
right.
And we saw what we thought was an airplane crash. Okay, so I'm being logical and rational people, we stopped at kind of a crossroads type thing there where you can take an upper road or lower road or we could go backwards. So if the plane crashed, you know, we'd get away from the explosion and everything.
Yes.
So we stopped there to decide what to do, you know, where the thing was coming down at. As I was looking up at it, you know, I was just scanning the thing. And the reason we were sure it was an airplane was because of the flashing red light and the two headlights, like landing lights, right?
Right.
I mean, I've seen enough airplanes. I know what landing lights are, the big beams that come down and everything.
Right.
And all of a sudden it dawned on me, you know, as I was looking up at it, I was looking at the lights, and the lights were going straight ahead. So the thing wasn't crashing at all. It was just giving, you know, the appearance of crashing. But what it was actually doing was flying level just above, you know, just above the treetops.
Yes.
So I said, okay, no sweat. And about this time, it was flying very slow. About this time, I said, Karen, there's no sound to that thing. You know, we were parked car and everything. I said, there's no sound. And then we looked up, and there wasn't any body to it. Now, that's what, anyway, this was what I said. Now, you said, didn't you say there wasn't any body, too?
Well, it looked as if you could see kind of...
It looked as if you could almost see through the middle of it. And this is how, anyway, it had that type of appearance where we knew it wasn't anything that we'd ever seen before. We knew it wasn't no wings, and it was triangular, right? You know, I mean, we could really see it well because it was almost right over us.
Yes.
And at that point, we decided that it wasn't anything that we wanted to have anything to do with. I mean, it literally scared the hell out of me.
Uh-huh.
And so I just stepped on the gas and got the hell out of there. And then about, as I was driving away, I said, God, you know, we really should follow that thing and see what it does. And by the time we turned around, it was gone.
I see.
And so I immediately reported it. Now, if you want a full description of it, triangular with flashing red light in between the two big, I call them headlights, and the Inquirer calls them searchlights, whatever, the big beams coming out of the front.
Yes.
Okay, I wouldn't swear on a stack of Bibles, but I had the impression from looking up at it that there was no body to the inside. How do you like that?
Well, in other words, you feel that the center was just completely hollow.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But now, Karen at the time didn't observe that. So I'm not perfectly sure of my judgment on that, you know.
Yes.
Okay. What have I forgotten, Karen? The big beams, triangular lights all the way around it. I mean, like, not like three lights. The lights were all the way around the perimeter of it.
Okay, how about the color of those lights? Again.
Okay, those were just regular lights.
White?
That's white lights.
White lights, okay.
They do not match what they evidently saw in North Carolina.
Yes. Were the lights continuous?
Were the lights continuous? They were, weren't they? Yeah, they were continuous.
Okay.
That's right. I mean, the only one that blinked was the red one in the middle.
Okay.
And like I said, I mean, we thought it was an aircraft to begin with until the last minute.
Uh-huh.
Pure speculation now. Something had to give the appearance of the thing crashing for us. I don't think it was flying parallel to the ground. You know what I mean? I think it was tilted.
I see.
Because, to give the appearance of crashing, it would seem to be the rear lights, and you know, would be slanted up, whereas the headlights would be coming straight out. Because I was sure of the headlights coming straight out. Because that's when I no longer feared the plane crashing, or whatever it was. You see what I'm...
Yes.
Do you have a picture in your mind what I'm talking about? It wasn't very high at all, and it was traveling very slow. Too slow for any normal aircraft, except for, of course, a helicopter, which can hover. But a helicopter at that distance, you'd definitely hear and everything else.
Uh-huh.
And we would have seen the props. Or, you know, we were looking for anything on the thing, but it was just a solid mass. Or at least the perimeter of the thing was. Okay, well,
do you have any visual estimates regarding how far away it was?
Okay, you take your ordinary tree, whatever, what's the height of about an ordinary cedar tree? Yeah. What are they, fir? And just the average fir tree in a forest and double it.
I see, okay.
All right, double or triple it, somewhere right in there.
That's still pretty low.
Yeah, very low.
Right.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Do you have any visual estimate regarding size?
Okay, size, Karen. It was bigger than the one that they saw. Yeah, they said the size of a Cadillac, and ours was bigger than that. Or the one that we saw was bigger than that. It wasn't much bigger than that. I'd say about 2 car lengths in length, and maybe a car length and a half in width.
Okay.
You're going to have to translate those things into feet, you know, just roughly.
Uh-huh. Would there be any possibility of getting a drawing of this from you?
Yeah, in fact, we made one right after we saw it, if we still have it. How do you like that?
That's great.
Karen, do we still have that drawing that we made right after we saw it? Yeah. We made it up at Camino right after we saw it, and I'd have to go up there and check to make sure that we still have it.
I see.
Yeah, with my mother cleaning, I don't know when she got. Yeah.
Okay, now, have you determined exactly what part of the island you were on at the time?
Yeah, it's Sunrise Boulevard.
Now, is that, what side of the island is that?
Okay, on? That would be the inside of the island facing Warm Beach. You know where Warm Beach is on the mainland there? Do you have a map?
Warm Beach?
Yeah, it's facing Warm Beach.
Okay.
Okay. Do you have a map there?
Not right here, no, but I have checked it on a map, and I couldn't find the name of that road on the map.
Yeah, that's because they just put it in this last year.
I see, okay.
Okay, so you won't find that road there except on an absolutely completely new map.
Okay.
All right, so it's the inside of the island facing, what direction would that be facing, Karen? Facing east. Well, the road that leads up where we saw the UFO.
Really,
the
facing southwest.
Which way was the UFO coming?
The UFO was going northwest. Or more northwest.
Yeah, the UFO was heading north to northwest.
Okay.
And we were looking at it. It seemed to come right over us. And we were situated at that time right there on the west side of the island, right? Okay, right as you come onto the island, right? All right, we're on the east side of the island. Okay.
Okay.
Right as you come on the island, there's a main road, and on any map, that road will fork. It will fork
right.
Either left or right.
Right.
And we began seeing it right there at the fork.
Right at the fork, okay. That's
okay.
Fine.
And then we didn't quite stop at the fork. We took a left turn on the fork. Okay, and then there's another branch in the road, and it was right at that branch where we finally stopped to make our decision of which way to go to get away from the crashing, which we thought at that time was an airplane.
Okay.
And it was coming, like I said, it was coming right over us, heading towards, kind of like it was heading towards Whidbey Island, right?
I see, okay. But how long do you feel you observed that?
Okay, how long did we observe that? Yeah, about three or four minutes. But we didn't stay to watch it, remember? As soon as we saw that it was something unidentified and we didn't know what it was, we made it.
Do you notice any interference with the car at the time? Was the car radio?
No. Now, this was another reason that we didn't want to stay, because I've heard about things like this happening before, and it was a dark road and a dark night, and we just weren't prepared for any kind of unusual happening.
Yes.
And there wasn't anything that did happen. There was another car that came down the other road, and it seemed to be, you know, from what we could observe, it wasn't having any type of interference at all. There was, you know, it was just, there was no contact made at all.
And did you report this to any agency other than the State Patrol?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Why, you want me to?
No, no, that's fine.
I had to borrow money to phone into the State Patrol. It was long distance, so believe me, I was pretty, I mean, we were pretty shook up.
Well, I can understand that. It takes person by surprise, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, if it happened again, I'd definitely stay and observe the whole thing, because I've been wanting to see one all my life, you know. And then it comes to the final moment, and what do? I check it out. So.
Well, I've often wondered what it would happen if I saw one myself.
So. Well, I'm going to be kicking myself in the rear end now for a long time. And I'm, you know, I write things off pretty easy. I mean, if I didn't just grab an inquirer, I probably never would have called you guys about it back. But that just, I mean, their description, I mean, it's just, okay, it seemed to be triangular or V-shape. I could make out reddish lights on one side, okay, or green on the other. That didn't miss. There was no sound at all, same as mine. Had one big spotlight, the first guy says, and the other one says, you know, two big spotlights. V-shaped with blue lights, ball of red light in the center. There were two big beams like searchlights. I'm reading from the Inquirer.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. Like I said, we didn't see it take off, but we went about a mile and turned around, and when we turned around, it was gone, but it was flying so low that it could have just gone into a hill or a gully or something like that.
Now, did those beams from the object, did they appear to be directed to the ground?
No. That's what I said. That's why I knew it was not crashing. They were completely parallel with the tops of the trees. When I first came out, I thought, you know, like I said, I thought the thing was crashing. But I still thought it was crashing until I focused my eyes on the beams. I mean, that's the logical thing to do, is look at the direction of the lights, and then you can tell whether it's coming down or whether it's flying level or what direction it's flying in. So until I focused my eyes on the two big beams that were coming out, I was still worried about the thing crashing. In other words, it was giving that impression of coming down. But it wasn't. It was flying parallel.
In other words, these beams were almost like headlights.
That's exactly what they were. Right. Were like big headlights.
Right.
Or airplane landing lights.
Okay, do you think that we could get a copy of that drawing?
Yeah.
And we would also like a map, it doesn't have to be too detailed, showing your position in relation to the object and object's movement.
All right.
And you have our address?
Did you send it when you... Did they send the address on that? Oh, I'm sure you did. You'd have a return address on the envelope.
Yes, oh yes.
Okay. So, and it might be about a week.
Oh, that's fine.
Because I have to get back up there again.
I see.
Stuff.
Now, could we have the name of the lady that was with you?
Yeah. Well, why don't you just talk to her? Hold on.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi there. You're a lucky one. I wonder if we could get your name for additional witness.
Okay, it's Karen.
Okay, that's great.
Yeah, that was really strange. You know, I occasionally pick up the Inquirer just for something extra to read, and it was on the back page. It was this week's issue, and I took a, well, they have a drawing of it, and I took one look at that, and I said, my God, you know, and so I quick read the article and called up Ted, says, you won't believe this. So
we released a story in relation to that activity back in North Carolina. Would you like me to send you a copy of it?
Yes, would you?
Sure would.
Yeah, I would be interested in that.
Sure.
Yeah, because I thought, wow, you know, and then, well, I can't even quite remember the date we saw this, the State Patrol. I don't know if they keep...
They have it on their record.
Oh, they do. Was that about the first part of June? Was that it? Do you have the record there? I can't even quite remember if it was the first part of June or July.
It's on that card that they sent me.
Mm. No, I've got the... It's upstairs in the office.
Yeah, because I can't quite remember when it was. But, now this one from North Carolina, I think, was first part of the year or something.
Right, it was in April. They were having quite a siege of reports there.
Mm-hmm.
Very low level.
Yeah, this one was very low. Well, I'm the one, I think, that when Ted was looking more at the road driving, I was looking around and first, I think I first spotted it and said, hey, look, there's a plane crashing.
Uh-huh.
And then we both started discussing it and slowing down and so forth. So, yeah, that was something else.
Okay, can I talk to Ted again?
Okay, fine.
Thank you. Well, we sure appreciate your calling, because this is what we refer to as a classic case because of the closeness.
Right. Now, is there any chance that I can find out any more information on the stuff they saw in Carolina?
Yes, I can send you a copy of that also.
I sure appreciate it. Yeah. And let them know that we spotted, one in the same family anyway, down here.
Uh-huh.
Because I've never seen, I read the things, too, whenever, I'm glancing through the papers or stores or anything.
Yes.
And it seems to be so much different than any of the others that have been spotted, lately. I mean, just this one. That's why I thought it was so unusual, is the fact that I had never seen any other, shape like this. And then all of a sudden, at the same, similar time, reading about these people in North Carolina that saw it.
Right. Well, this triangular shape has been seen quite a bit since the North Carolina activity. And we're just wondering if we're not dealing with an entirely new race.
Oh, yeah.
Visiting the area.
Uh-huh. Well, there's no chance that it could be military or anything like that.
No, that's been discounted completely.
Uh-huh. Well, you've been following it then for quite a while, huh?
Oh, yes. 20 years.
Not this type, though, huh?
Off and on, a triangular shape will show up. It has over the years.
With the beams and the flashing lights?
Not necessarily with the beams, no.
Yeah. See, this is what was so unusual to me, and that's why I was so convinced at the beginning that it was an airplane.
Uh-huh.
When you're convinced it's an airplane, it takes quite a bit to convince you that it's not. Right. You know what I mean?
Stop on the gas.
That's right. Okay, well, I'll get those papers to you.
Beautiful.
Bring them out, and I hope you can give me some more information, too.
If we do, we'll let you know.
Okay, thanks an awful lot.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.